listening to. So three of us will eventually be giving out their email address that you can ask them specific questions. Paul is our expert on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing lately, and there's some great things going on there. John is the guy who does the interfacing, among other things, with the new amateurs who don't yet have their ham license, so they're sending us snail mails, emails, and so on, and asking questions on the things that they feel that they have to know in order to get their license. The main thing that TechNet is a forum where the clan of ham radio operators meet, and we educate each other. Lots of smart people have said that mankind really makes progress when they display curiosity. So you've got to see a common denominator among the people who gather at this particular net. They've got curiosity about wireless products, among other things, wireless hardware. How does that antenna, transmission line, transmitter, receiver, modulator, demodulator, space, hardware, moon bounce, meteor scatter, how does all that stuff work? There's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. And the 2-meter FM ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of them. Let me get up. The subjects discussed on the ham, on the TechNet are primarily the subjects you guys bring by asking questions. Very rarely does Paul, John, or I have a CAN program for the main portion of the TechNet. Paul does gather information about space hardware, but the rest of what takes place is what you guys ask. We try to tap into the huge brain power that exists in the tri-state area near New York City. This repeater covers New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, most major portions of those three states. However, since Eric, T2EJ, and Andy, the B2CDL, have hooked up this machine to EchoLink and IRLP, we do get people signing in from the far west places, and they're also capable of asking questions. We're going to try to leave enough time. Each time you drop, you should wait for the four beeps, and maybe a second or two beyond, to make sure all the hardware connected to this repeater gets properly reset. Therefore, a person far away has a chance to chime in and ask his particular question. A person signs into the TechNet by giving John, Paul, and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign in just because you're listening. This particular net is net number 1,449 of the series of TechNets that began in September 1982, the 30th year of this TechNet. By now, we assume somebody is listening, or it wouldn't have lasted this long. The fact that it's lasted this long, let me drop. It partially proves that there is, in my opinion, a huge thirst for knowledge about wireless hardware. By my standards, almost all of the schools teaching radio techniques do at best a mediocre job of it. You really want a person who understands two-way equipment, radio equipment, wireless equipment, hire a ham radio operator, particularly one who's got curiosity, one who's got the enthusiasm to build his own antenna, experiment with his own transmitter, talk to other people who are doing it, and trade knowledge. So that's what's going on here. So from my point of view, that's the only place where real apprenticeship in the real world is taking place. There are too few companies that have got a well-established antenna department, radio department. Let me drop. By which a person can get the needed 10 years of apprenticeship to become a good wireless engineer. There are some people who think it takes 10 years of apprenticeship. And the schools think that they're giving you a foundation. Well, I'm not so sure about that. Giving you an awful lot of information that's not directly usable, useful engineering information. By comparison, the person taking a course in computer science, engineering science, can come out of that school and start becoming useful pretty soon. A person who wants to study wireless engineering, he comes out of the school, he cannot design an antenna, he cannot design a transmitter, he cannot design a receiver. I'm not even sure he could design a transformer, or a transmission line. So there's an awful not lacking. And so the people who meet here try to correct some of that need. So the fact that the technet is listed so long shows that there's a huge thirst for knowledge, a great big gap between what people know and what they would like to know. The questions that you ask for on the technet, there's no such thing as a dumb question, so don't worry about that. Let me drop. The philosophy of the three of us is that a so-called dumb question is really a situation where there's a bigger gap between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. If you think about that in the big picture, that's the question most deserving of an answer. By triage, he's the guy who is most needy, and you'll get the most amount of benefit, the biggest bang for the dollar if you talk to the guy with the dumb question, as long as you don't take an elitist attitude and ridicule him, which is kind of crazy. And there are people who do that. A person signs in by, as I said, giving your question, your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WA2PJF, veto, and yes. So, for those who would like to sign in tonight, during the first hour, we'll try to give you a brief answer, followed by the mailbag, followed by the space report, and then we go, if the time left over, into deeper subjects. So give me a call, let us a name right now. H-U-R-I-W.
H-2-M-M-Y, Ray, yes?
We got you, Ray. Anyone else? My goodness, there's got to be somebody out there with some questions. You mean to tell me I could give you guys a pop quiz, and you would all know how all of this hardware works, and you have no further questions? Who else out there has got a question? Give me the call letters and name right now. K2LIW. Here you go. I think I heard a very quick KE2EJ. Some unknown guy named Eric. Okay. We got you, Eric. Anyone else?
N2LDY. Don. Yes.
Okay. Lima Delta Yankee. We got you, Don. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me a call. It is a name right now.
E3ZZZ. Scott. Yes.
Okay. That's one of those guys signing it from a long distance away. Scott lives way up there in Canada. He has a so-called golden horseshoe section of the high popularity section of Canada. My guess is he's probably 800 miles or so from us, airline. All right, we've got more than enough to get going. And Ray, you're number one on the runway. K2, Mike Yankee. K2LAW, go ahead, Ray.
Good evening, Jack, and hello to everyone on the TechNet. Jack, I was wondering, maybe it sounds like a simple question, maybe it's not a simple answer. What type of radio wave travels further per pound? Is it a long wave or a short wave? They used to think it was a long wave because they hug the earth and go to the ocean and this kind of thing. I think I was taught or told that. But I'm starting to think it's a short wave, that these 900 megahertz and 1.2 gigahertz frequencies can be a very little wattage and go very, very far distances. And also they tend to use the short wave when they're talking out of nanospace. So I guess my simple question is, which wave travel further per wattage, long or short? Back to you, thank you.
That's a very deep question, Ray. There is no one answer. It's kind of a function of what you by far, the longest range in hardware that mankind has ever created in the last 48 billion years, the history of the time of the longest piece of hardware is the Voyager spacecraft. Voyager is out there 110 astronomical. sideband transverter. In other words, I feed a 2 meter sideband signal into it. Let me drop. I feed in a 2 meter signal, 144 megs. It translates it up to 10,368 megs, 10.368 gigahertz. 200 milliwatts comes out into the 2 foot dish. All the electronics hangs in a box behind the dish, because wave guides to the top of the 100 foot tower would have a whole lot of loss. So I only feed 144 meg signal up there. 172 is the frequency. You could say the thing is multiplying the frequency by 72, but it's not. It's mixing it with an oscillator, translating it to from 144. You mix 10.224 gigahertz with 0.144 gigahertz, that's 2 meters, and out comes 10.368, the internationally agreed upon calling frequency. Ham radio operators own 500 megahertz of that ham band, 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz, 500 megahertz of width. You couldn't make wideband television or high-speed data fast enough to use that frequency. And we have essentially free reign to use that. Okay. So in my case, that talks 380 miles on 200 milliwatts. So with highly directive dish antennas, a parabolic dish antenna, at these higher frequencies with the wavelength of full, where you're squirting the signal like a flashlight, if you can see the signal coming out of that 2 foot dish of mine, let me drop it. It would look just like a flashlight. You aim the flashlight in the right direction. You get on 144.260, the calling frequency on 2 meters, and you say, is anybody around during the cut test that would like to talk on 10 gig? And some guy on Equinox Mountain in Vermont answers you on 2 meters and says, aim your antenna at me. You transmit first, and I'll aim my antenna at you and vice versa. And then once you finish using the talkback frequency on 144, you both flip over to 10 gigs and complete the QSO on sideband, CW, whatever. And so in my case, 200 milliwatts has allowed me to talk to guys in 10 states on that frequency. So you can see that small amounts of power, high gain antennas, the right technology can go very far. That's one approach. The other approach is if Mother Nature's ionosphere is going to favor you. If the 10-meter band is open and the ionosphere is acting like a beautiful mirror and reflecting that signal, milliwatts of signal in the Morse code mode, CW mode, on 28 megacycles can allow you to talk worldwide when the band is in good shape. So the nice thing about 10 gigs is that it's very dependable when you're talking about space. When it comes to beautiful distances you can get on 6 meters, 10 meters, 20 meters. The good news, you can get some very long distances when the ionosphere favors you. If the ionosphere doesn't favor you, the down part of the sunspot cycle, you can blast with a kilowatt on 28 megacycles, and the guy 1 state away will hear you by ground waves, and that's about it, if there's no ionosphere. So there you have to You have to study Mother Nature and choose the right time of year or the right year. So there is no one answer, as you can tell, Ray. Each one of those bands, let me drop. As I said, there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. Everything from very low frequencies. We have some allocations where you're allowed to use frequencies. You're allowed to use frequencies the refraction of a megacycle, and you're allowed to use frequencies, some of my buddies are using 243 gigahertz. There, the wavelength is a couple of thousandths of an inch. A piece of waveguide that couples that signal to the antenna only has to be a 16th of an inch of inside diameter to couple that signal, and no semiconductor required. So the guys way up there on these super high frequencies. All kinds of ham radio. So mankind is using 20 different kinds of wireless products. Your cordless phone, your cell phone, your automatic control, your wireless control for the automobile, the wireless control for the garage door opener, the television set. It just goes on and on. I saw a wireless radio controlled stump grinder was being used on the property alongside of my house last year. All kinds of wireless products. And so the guys who design that stuff but the guys that get treated very well. He studied that field of wireless radio equipment, and get some kind of a degree that will be respected. You will be respected. People will be a path to your door. So throw money at you. I'm exaggerating a little bit. You know what I mean. So you're in the right hobby. You're in the right place at the right time, as I see it, right? That's only a little bit of a story, but maybe it helps a little. KC2, Mike Yankee. Crazy question. A good one. K2RIW.
Okay, Jake, I meant to exclude the skit type thing, but just to add to it a little bit more and let you go, why do you use then the VLS for submarines? Does water not like, high frequencies? And, and a side note, the whales tend to talk across the ocean with their very low frequency sound that they make. They have to use VLS for the submarines to get through the water, and I think I'll close with that. Thank you.
Yeah, this all boils down to the fact that water at radio frequencies is an extremely absorptive process. When you're putting that food of yours in the microwave oven, 90-some-odd% of the cooking of your food is taking place because the food contains water. Water is a bipolar molecule. In other words, it's a little bit like a dumbbell where one side is positive and one side is negative. You got two hydrogens on one side, one oxygen on the other side. You got pluses and minuses. And that water molecule in liquid form only wants to flip back and forth and follow each and every cycle of that 2.4 gigahertz coming out of that microwave oven, because it tries to follow and flip back and forth 2.4 billion times per second. It ends up absorbing quite a bit of energy, and the water gets hot. Most of the cooking of your food is the water absorbing the RF energy, turning it into heat, and that's what cooks your food. Okay? That seawater, when you try to send a signal through it, it's got the exact same absorptive property. So until you get down to some very low frequencies, in the tens of kilohertz, is the way you talk to a submarine. Until you get down to some very low frequencies, the water absorption is so high that the signal doesn't go there. You try to transmit a 2-meter signal through water, and after about 20 feet, with a super sensitive receiver and a high power transmitter, after 20 feet of seawater, I think you'd have trouble picking up that kilowatt of 2-meter signal, because the water is such a lossy material. Water and air both communicate at much lower frequencies with much less loss, both acoustically and radio-wise. That meteorite that hit Chernobyl, I think is the name of the town in Russia. That meteor that hit Russia, they picked it up on this array of 45 ultra-low frequency microphones, you could call it, scattered around the world looking for a nuclear blast. But by listening to the very low acoustic frequencies picked up by those microphones around the world, that allowed to find out exactly how big was that meteor. You take a look at the latest issue of Sky and Telescope magazine, a beautiful article about exactly how they estimated the direction of arrival, how big it was, how fast it was moving, how much sound it made, how much earthquake shake it made, and so on. So elephants use very low frequencies to transmit audio over very long distances. Whales use very low frequencies in water to transmit audio over very long distances. And we humans use the very low frequency portion of the sound by a meteor impact to figure out the direction of arrival and so on. So each frequency range of audio, RF, each medium, there are specific frequencies that work well. We amateurs, let me drop. Way back in the early days of broadcast radio, where radio was running around 1 megahertz, somehow someone came to the conclusion that those higher frequencies, 3, 7, 14, and 28 megacycles, those real high frequencies are useless. They gave them to ham radio operators to experiment with. Boy, did they changed their tune on that one real fast when the ham started using 20 meters and started talking not one town away, but one continent away on even the old-fashioned stock jam transmitters. As you develop the right hardware, the right antennas, transmitters, and receivers for the higher and higher frequencies, we keep finding out every 10 or 20 years in time, mankind goes up another 10 to 1 higher in frequency. We keep going up to what we think are going to be the useless frequencies, and we find out, boy, they're not useless. We keep discovering that over and over again. So, you ain't heard the end of the story yet, Ray. KC2MMY for any final on this one. K2RIW in the tech man.
Okay, Dick, but I got a lot better understanding of it. I ventured just to ask, well, this is a line of sight. Not a different. This line of sight on the Earth, you know, it seems that the higher frequencies are going further on just a tiny bit of power. Maybe that's the antenna directivity, but and maybe it isn't. But can I is that a true statement, or is it just... It just depends on that season.
You're right on, Ray. I could use an omnidirectional antenna, an antenna that transmits the signal in all directions at once. And of course, it's not concentrating its power. You could, if you wanted to, use a flashlight with just a bulb and no parabolic reflector on it. And it works. You're not going to see the light anywhere near as far. You put a parabolic reflector on that light bulb of the flashlight, you point it all in one direction, you get a much brighter beam where you aim it. So yes, the higher the frequency, the more aiming you can do. How sharp a beam you can get out of a flashlight light device or a parabolic dish antenna is strictly a function of how many wavelengths wide is the parabolic reflector. Rough rule of thumb is you take the number of wavelengths of width of your parabolic reflector, divide it into 70 degrees, and what comes out is the beam width in degrees. So if I was operating at 10 gigahertz where the wavelength is 1 inch, my parabolic reflector was 70 inches in diameter, 70 divided into 70 degrees would be 1 degree. A 70 wavelength parabolic dish will have a beam width of 1 degree. Boy, as long as you can aim it accurately, that's going to give you some real nice range. As you can tell, the next step beyond that is you can really get a lot of very sharp aim with a laser beam. So laser communication has the capability of going very far in the distance, even in space. That's it. And there are some very exotic military satellites where from ground to satellite you talk to it on a laser beam. Really watts of power. Carefully aimed at that satellite to do the job. So you got it right. Either you avoid the skip, you're just talking about line of sight. The sharper the beam width, the higher the directivity, usually the higher the frequency, will give that to you if you can aim it properly. But now you got to make sure you got the right kind of aiming equipment. And so, as plus and minuses, and the desirable frequency, there's the best frequency for each situation. And you, as a ham radio operator, are touching the hardware, talking to the people who are doing it, learning how to do it, and therefore, you're becoming the expert, right? Eric works in the broadcast industry where he transmits real high power in a lot of directions at once. That's what a VHF, UHF, television broadcast transmitter does. But now he does it in a different way. He gets his directivity not by aiming it like a pencil beam, but aiming it like a pancake. He's using an antenna that's many wavelengths high, but it's an omnidirectional antenna. You can see the beam coming out of that transmitting antenna of his in plain view. It is a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. He doesn't waste any power going straight up or straight down. All aimed at the horizon. K3J. The high power guy, the guy with the highest power transmitter we can talk to. You got it, Eric. K2LAW in the tech man.
All right. K2LAW, K3J. Actually, I don't go in all directions. I have a Smith headed. No point in putting energy in the Atlantic Ocean because it's kind of wasted. I just want to query you on the ever moving saga of duplexing. So anyway, I've made my light film matches, and they work very well. But now, when I try to combine the two, now don't forget that I'm thinking of 50 ohms is working with these. It's about 100. If I had a one nice Wilkinson combiner, divider, it would be cool. So I've got, one frequency at 920 and another one at 900. And I've made my lovely little notches on each opposing side. When I put them together, they kind of mess each other up a little bit. And that's really, those 250 ohm ports, looking at like 25 ohms. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree, and I'm awful glad you asked the question. It's a little bit like what happens if I'm putting a 2-meter antenna and a 6-meter antenna on the same mast. And they're both great big long Yagis. And somebody asked the question, how far are they going to be apart? When I'm transmitting into that 6-meter Yagi, the 2-meter Yagi absolutely is there, clearly transparent. And 98% is true in the other direction. When I'm transmitting on 2 meters, the 6-meter antenna is not there. It's highly reactive, it's transparent, it's got no real gain. They don't see each other. You snap them extremely close. Okay? In the case of your duplexing filter, you've got a very carefully tuned band pass for the transmitter, a very carefully tuned band pass for the receiver. The way a filter works is not great. We think we're designing a filter so that it passes a signal. That's sort of what it does. There's something a lot more magic than that. At the desired frequency of your filter, input impedance of 50 ohm, output impedance of 50 ohm, insertion loss is some small number, a few tenths of a dB. That's the passband. How does the filter reject? Everybody doesn't realize that what a filter does, when I go above the bandpass frequency or below, the filter in most cases becomes a dead, short circuit on the stop frequency. If that filter is tuned to 920 plus or minus 1 megacycle, and I plug in a signal of 900, and I put my vector network analyzer on the input of that filter, I will see something very close to a dead short with some length of line between the connector and where the short is located, somewhere downrange inside the filter. So, for the transmit frequency, the receiving filter is a dead short. For the receiving frequency, the transmitting filter is a dead short. Therefore, at the T connector, going to the antenna where the two filters become combined, there is a very magic length of cable from the phase center of the filter where the short circuit really is up to that T connector. You would like, in the case of the transmit frequency, you would like the receiver filter and to have, let me think now, a odd number of quarter wavelengths of effective cable between that filter and that T connector, odd number of quarter wavelengths, so that the short circuit of the filter looks like an open circuit at the center of the T on that frequency. So there's a magic length of cable for the transmit K of filter going to the T and the receiver filter going to the T. And once you've got that magic length of cable, on the transmit frequency, the antenna sees a 50 ohm load to the transmit filter only. It sees an absolute open circuit into the receiver filter, because the receiver filter is a short circuit with an odd number of quarter wavelengths between that key connector and that filter, and vice versa. So that's what happens on a transmitter and receiver. So it is not, absolutely not, a pair of 50 ohm filters in parallel. Absolutely not. Because of the frequency filtering characteristic, when it's done right, at each one of those frequencies, transmit frequency or receive frequency, there is only one single 50 ohm source to that antenna. and he does the other one on that frequency. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Eric. There's quite a bit more magic required in the careful selection of the length of cable between the key connector and those two filters. But when you get it right, that thing will fit. And you'll say, boy, that's a magic piece of technology. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is
WKJJ.
Now, I was totally aware of it, Dick, and actually I have that magic, but you didn't listen carefully to what I was saying. Okay, I've got an external notch. A notch that's opposing each other. So let's say I've got one notch at 900 on the transmit side to prevent any energy from coming out at 900. And I've got one notch at 927 on the receive side to prevent any of the 900 transmit energy from getting into the receiver. If I eliminate those notches, I've got a perfect situation between the two of them where the golf band patches are correctly spaced, they look lovely, the insertion loss is very low, works beautifully into a T. Okay? But because these notches, these stubs are external to it, and I've tried a number of different ways of changing the wavelength just to make sure that they're not the same wavelength. They interact with each other. So if you take and you look at that, by the way, these bare patch filters have a relatively low Q. They're like a megahertz wide, they're not very narrow. So that being the situation, and I think I did come up with a solution, but we'll get there in a second. Keep going up to KE2EJ.
The explanation I gave about the short circuit, open circuit characteristics of filters on two different frequencies for a duplexing filter, a transmitting, receiving duplexing filter for a single antenna type repeater. The majority of the reason I went to that is I'm hoping other people listening would like to know that information. And I was 98% sure that you already knew it. I know it's a little bit insulting to have to listen to it again. Now, in the previous conversations you and I have had, you talked about putting a T connector in the coupling loop between the cans of the filter in order to develop the notch. And I know that very few of the commercial products do it that way, and I'm going to make a guess why. When you put the reacting device, whether it be an inductor or a capacitor, across the loop that the pickup device inside the filter itself. That pickup loop inside the filter could be described as the phase center of the filter. And by co-locating the extra reactants there, that gives you the notch that you desire. Now the phase center, the absolute phase position, the point of origin of the notch and the point of origin of the bandpass are essentially co-located. And yet, when it comes to testing one or two filters at a time, two cavities alongside of each other with a coupling loop between them, and the stub tuner in that loop, you can make the passband look right. Let me drop it. But now you've got a different phase center for the notch compared to the passband. Now you've got a much more difficult job, as I see it, selecting the right length of cable that gives you the short and open characteristic at the two simultaneous frequencies, the passband frequency and the notching frequency. You've now got what's called the Chinese remainder theorem mathematics. There's a much more difficult set of eigenvalues. Let me drop for a second. There's now a much more difficult set of eigenvalues, selectable cable lengths, that'll simultaneously fulfill the need of the notch being in the right place, lengthwise, number of wavelengths downrange from the antenna T connector versus the phase center of the filter itself. So the disadvantage of putting your stub in that coupling loop between the cavities is now the length of cable to the towing device, the non-length cable to the passband device are not the same length of cable. Therefore, it's a much more difficult. It's doable, but it's much more difficult. And my guess is that's probably where you ran into a more troublesome situation. Is that true, Eric? And that the best you stand your ground here, in my opinion, K2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Correct. P2RWK, CJ. Well, what I do is I pulled out, I opened up MASCAD and actually calculated the length and the multiple. And I went through a whole series of arrays to see if I could find one that actually fit right at those specific frequencies. But then it dawned on me. We could look at them individually. Well, I'm looking for a reaction to zero ohm and I've got things so that it looks exactly right. Each single element, let's say, on the receive side, I've got it perfect. A perfect notch, perfect damn head, actually an insertion loss is just about a little more than 1 dB. I do the same thing on the transmit side. Alright, so now it's a matter of really trying to calculate the wavelengths of each connecting line so that there's that minimum interaction. One has to look like it's short, one has to look like it's open. No matter what I've worked out sort of on paper, but in reality is I can't really get it. I mean, I can get it good, but I can't get it like I'd really like it because it does affect the bandpass of the opposing filter. So, I came up with this really dumb idea. I took it through my junk, and I came up with a little circulator. What do you think of that idea?
I think you don't want to use a circulator, Eric. The circulator will pass a signal in one direction and acts like a 50 ohm load with an extremely high insertion loss in the other direction. That's not what you want. You do not want to present a 50 ohm load on the other frequency. You want to create a perfect short or a perfect open. So I think using a circulator is going to be more troublesome, and it's got insertion loss, and it's got power limitations on the transmit side. I don't think you want to go there. I am guessing that the notch-generating reactant, which classically is put on the coupling loop inside the cavity, you didn't do that because, one, it's more difficult to get there and tune it, and number two, you've got this beautiful, pristine cavity. You don't want to disturb it. You didn't want to take it apart to add the nulling device. However, if you bite the bullet, open the cavity, put the tunable reactant nulling device on the pickup loop itself, it is my guess that a lot of the interaction problems become simpler. To properly model this on MASCAD, I think is a very difficult problem. You're starting to see the difference between what MASCAD says and what your vector network analyzer is saying. What your spectrum analyzer is saying. Have a job.
The VNA.
Okay, so you are using a vector network analyzer. And with the vector network analyzer properly calibrated, you can find out exactly how many wavelengths there is between the short circuit on the nulling frequency versus the 50 ohm phase center in the passband frequency. And so, properly interpreted, that Smith chart display of a vector network analyzer, or putting it into the mode where it measures nanoseconds of delay or degrees of delay on those two different frequencies, I think the raw data is there by which you can do it. But I think it's much more difficult to have the matching not co-located with the phase center of each one of the cavity filters itself. To your knowledge, tell me this one now, Eric. Have you found literature where there is a track record of putting the key connector nulling device, the subtuner, in the middle of the coupling loops between the cavities as a well-tuned duplexing filter? Does that concept have history? Is there a recipe in somebody's well-respected article that has done it that way? Because I think it is the very unlikely way to do it. It is not the classic way. So does that approach have history, Eric?
KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I haven't actually gone looking for any such literature, but I do know from my experience working with various kinds of reflecting filters where that, say, for example, the name of the company, not Wacom, there's a number of different companies that actually do a hybrid ring, that's what I'm looking for. In the hybrid ring itself, you create the stuff, create the notches, you use the cavities themselves as fantastic. And of course, the cable length is critical. And as the cable breaks, of course, the thing gets stuck in the crap. I question what you're saying about this particular, because like I know my microwave here, when I go into a single antenna, even though I have band pass filters on each channel, depending upon where I place them in the waveguide, I use them for both bands and receive, but of course I'm only talking, you know, 10 watts, 5 watts, 3 watts, so I'm talking 70 watts, but in my channel 13 transmitter, I've got a circulator that handles 5,000 watts, which is the essence. But the interesting thing is that I don't have a VNA. All I can do is sweep. And interestingly enough, because when you think about the circuit, let me drop the thing. Well, the antenna is the main point. Outgoing point would be the transmitter. The incoming point would be the receiver. And when you sweep it, it looks very, very pretty. And, you know, of course, if you see it backwards, it looks messed up. But I respect that. And using the service monitor, looking for the interaction between the two frequencies, it doesn't seem to exist.
What's that guy again, Eric? He said, when you sweep it backwards, it looks bad. Are you telling me that if I took the antenna port of your duplex filter, when there are broadband 50 ohm loads on the transmitting port and the receiving port, when you sweep it backwards, are you telling me you don't see 50 ohms on first the receive frequency and then 50 ohms on the transmit frequency, and what it does in between and what it does in the subband frequency? Yeah, it's going to go to hell and gone. But you're telling me you don't see a desirable impedance when you feed it backwards? Run that by again. A KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Visualize it. You've got a passband that's, say, it's 1 dB, and you've got a notch that's at like 90. So, if you say the feed you sweep into where you're going to be connecting your antenna, and you take the point that you're going to use to go to the input of the bandpass filter with the notch in it, and you look at the output of that while you have the transmitter bandpass filter at a notch terminated, so you're only talking a signal source at this moment, and you look at that, it looks exactly like you expect it to with a little bit more incision line. Okay. Now, to reverse the leads on your generator and your spectrum analyzer, and you move the output, or the input to the spectrum analyzer, to where you'll be hooking the antenna on the circulator, and you hook the output of the sweep into the beginning of the transmit bandpass filter, and you'll then see the nice bandpass and the opposing notch with an insertion loss of around 1 dB. It looks really good.
Okay, so now,
let's say on the transmit side, you reverse the connection between the input of the sweep source and the spectrum analyzer. So now, you're actually trying to feed it in through the circulator, which means you've got to go past that other port, whereas if you just think about it, goes clockwise, yeah, it goes clockwise. So the first output would be the receiver port, and the next output would be where you'll be coming in with the transmitter. You actually see stuck out. You'll see the cancellation at the opposing frequencies where there should be bandpass is actually an issue. So, go figure.
two transmissions ago, you had told me you were thinking of adding a circulator. And at first I thought the circulator was going to go between transmitter and the first cavity, or between the transmitting cavities, or between the antenna port and the receiver cavities, or between the receiver cavities. I thought it was going to be a simple two-port circulator plus termination. You didn't tell me, but I think you're now describing the circulator is being used where all three ports are active. There is no termination of the circulator, and it's being used in a different manner to try to make this all come out right. That's what I think I'm hearing right now. That's a much more complicated system. I don't think many commercial duplexing filters for ham radio applications do it that way. And so I'm wondering, what is the track record and history of that approach that I think I'm hearing right now? There's a lot of hidden information you haven't been giving me here, Eric. It's clear to you because you're there and you're doing it. But the words you transfer this to me over the air didn't convey all of this in the past. K2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet, we're all learning this.
Well, I didn't try to use the transmitter right there. Well, I did give you the example of it in my microwave system. We use circulators to combine it. So naturally, I would think, you know, if I like the 3-4 circulator, that's not that one output that disseminates and to take the reflected load and get stuff that makes heat out of
it. Yeah.
But the end result is, I think, I'm going to leave it this way because it seems to work. And I don't seem to get any appreciable defect thing that I can measure. So it seems to me like a good way to go.
Now, back in the days of analog broadcast before you went digital, Eric, where now you had diflexing filtering, where you're combining a audio transmitter and a video transmitter into one antenna in some cases, and there it's all in one direction using circulating filters on a diflexing filter makes a lot of sense. But in a duplexing filter, where you're transmitting simultaneously and receiving from the same antenna on slightly different frequencies, I think the circulator usage is a much more difficult application. Do I have that one wrong, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
Well, let's go into your frequency. Say on my 12 gig or my 6 gig microwave, okay? I've got my WR that goes in a vertical direction, comes from the antenna. And I've got a channel filter on the back of each one. One's a receiver, one's a transmitter. It doesn't matter which way I put them together. And at the end of each one of those channel filters, there's a little circulator. And depending upon which way I flip that circulator, either set it up to be a transmit port or a receive port. I don't see it being any different than that.
Okay, interesting stuff. So, now to bring it down to the bottom line. I think you were pursuing four cavities, not six cavities, to build the duplexing filter for your 900 meg system. You got the advantage of quite a number of megacycles of separation that will make things a little bit easier. To my knowledge, you're starting off with what previously were bandpass filter cans, and you're combining in various combinations to homebrew a duplexing filter. And because I think you don't want to open up these pristine filters, you didn't therefore co-locate the notching device inside on the loop the conventional way of doing it. And so, are you getting close to what you believe is an operating system where you've got what you believe to be the right insertion loss on transmitting and receiver and the right amount of notching so you won't experience receiver desensitization from the transmitter? Is that approximately where you are? I know you were requesting from me to see if I could find a circulator and, a directional coupler, and I wasn't successful on that one so far, Eric. So where do you stand right now, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
WKCJR. I'm ready to go put the stuff up there. I on the bench, that's it with the transmitter and receiver. Two different test sets. Test set antenna. Really low signals. Things open up at about 0.2 of a microvolt. Can't tell if there's a transmitter going. My meter is about 45 watts, so nothing gets hot, which is truly amazing. It's pretty intense to get warm at 13. So, yeah, I'm ready to go.
That sounds real good, Jeff, Eric.
By the way, if you guys are hearing any undesired signals, so-called jamming signals or whatever in the background, you'll do us a great favor if you flip over your transceiver into the receive mode, into the listen to the alternate mode, if you know what I mean, listen to the reverse, so you can hear the amplitude of the undesired signal. Carefully report what amplitude you hear and the time that you hear it, and report that to us. Don't tell us over the air. Tell us by internet on the website RFI@LIMARC.org. RFI@LIMARC.org. That's where you should report what you hear, and it'll help us locate this undesirable person that's doing this. Good luck with that project, Eric. And sounds like I'm looking forward to the time we've got a 900 meg link between the eastern input and the western input of this particular repeater. That'll give us all kinds of advantages. And you and I have discussed some of this in the past. Getting rid of the latency of the internet interconnection, for instance. The next person who signed in was Don, M2LZY. And Don, how are those smart people in Center Reach? What are they doing these days? You got it, Don. M2LZY, take your repeat. Time out.
Center Reach. Modulate like
on Texas, my timer is timing out, to modulate like something like 60 to 80 volts DC. So the pulse width modulator would have one voltage, like it, that would run on 12 volts, and then it would drive this other circuit, and the other circuit would be at, you know, driving the, modulating the 80 volts, and they would have a common ground. I was just wondering if you had any dealings with working with that.
Yes, I do, but not in this application. And I think you're describing an arc welder, Don, and if not, you're going to correct me on that one. In the case of an arc welder, that's a very severe requirement. If you really look at the plasma of the arc when it's under operation, and if you looked at it with a high-frequency oscilloscope, that whole circuit is flipping back and forth between very short high current events followed by high voltage low current events fed by the inductive feedback of the welding circuit itself. So a good welding circuit on welder. I don't know if you could get field effect transistors to survive in that environment. And so I'm a bit confused by that. On top of that, typical arc welding of the kind that's used for an automobile, we've got very large number of amperes. The 15 amperes and a 12-volt power supply you're talking about, if you're doing some kind of micro welding on a printed circuit board, yes. But if you're trying to weld pieces of steel, I'm troubled by that. Now,